I have a reading for you this morning from the writings of John O'Donohue, whom you may be counting among your blessed ancestors. This is his blessing, Benach, which is perhaps his most well-known. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the gray window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colors, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the curve of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. Wind, work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. In this last month of July, I have been to the Petroglyph Provincial Park in Ontario, Canada. I've been to the Thoreau Wabanaki Festival in Greenville, Maine. And I've been to the 10th Healing the Wounds of Turtle Island ceremony in Monroe, Maine. In each of these experiences, I was in the presence of, and perhaps, probably, surrounded by the ancestors of Indigenous people. In all three of these places, we were very welcome and encouraged and made to feel loved. The petroglyphs in Ontario is the largest collection of petroglyphs in a single place in all of Canada. And the petroglyphs, they think, are 600 to 1,000, maybe more, years old. And that Native people gathered in that place because of the land and being near the water for hundreds and hundreds of years and held their ceremony and etched their petroglyphs into the rock face. And as you look at it, you can see early style art, middle art, and 500-year-old art all in the same place. And Indigenous people say, particularly in the wintertime, but they say, usually in the quiet time of the day, which might be after sunset, you can hear the voice of the ancestors because water runs underneath the rock face and the voices come up through the fissures in the rock. I didn't hear it, but it's a blessing to know that someone does. Someone does. The Thoreau Wabanaki Festival, what a hoot. I didn't realize, this was the 10th annual or 20th annual, 20th annual Thoreau Wabanaki Festival. We claim Henry David Thoreau is one of our ancestors. He might or might not be happy about that. The Thoreau people talked about how Thoreau was so deeply interested in connecting to the place where he was, the land. So when he was at Walden Pond for a scant 2 years, he learned every plant, every rock, everything that would grow there. He learned about ice in, he learned about ice out, he kept records. I think you probably all know that Thoreau's records of plants and weather and water are used today by climate scientists to measure how things have changed. He was that precise and accurate, and he knew the spirits of that place. And then he came up to the Maine woods. He wanted to see what he could find in the wilderness. Hence the Thoreau Wabanaki Festival. For when Thoreau came to Maine, as you know, he didn't know where he was, he didn't know what he was doing, he'd never been in the wilderness. Anybody who thinks Walden Pond is in the wilderness needs to go visit. It's a mile and a half out of Concord, I think, right? And right now it's you can almost see it from Interstate 90. So he wanted a wilderness experience, and he took all manner of transport to get to Bangor. And he took a steamer and then a stagecoach from Bangor to Greenville. And in Greenville, he met up with a Penobscot, and he hired a Penobscot to be his guide into the wilderness. And he made three trips to Maine. And during that time, well, when Thoreau first got here, he expected, now, if you say I said this, I might have to deny it. He expected to encounter the noble savage. He expected to encounter an Indian in a loincloth carrying a bow and arrow, talking broken English. And what he did encounter were the Penobscots living on Indian Island, already living on the Indian Island, who were wearing Western dress and speaking perfect English. And he was disappointed. He was disappointed. But nevertheless, he wanted to go into the wilderness. His first guide was Joe Adian. Adian is a good Penobscot name. He went up to Katahdin, he went to climb Katahdin, he couldn't get to the top. So in true transcendental style, when he couldn't get to the top of Katahdin, he determined that the gods had determined that man should not get to the top of the mountain. Several of the women in this room have been to the top, and several of the men have been to the top, so we flaunt the gods in that way. By the third trip, his guide was Joe Polis. Thoreau got to know Joe Polis in a way that he probably only knew one or two other people in his whole life. And Joe would tell Thoreau stories. They were in the wilderness for, I think his last trip was 3 weeks. He was on the east branch of the Penobscot up to Chillicothe Lake and places like that. And he got to understand the Penobscot Indian in a whole different way. And he appreciated their tradition. Joe Polis would tell him where the ancestors had been and how the ancestors would help Joe find his way. Joe knew every leaf, every twig, every plant, and every animal in the North Maine woods where he was. And Thoreau really fell in love with that and respected it. At Healing the Wounds of Turtle Island, that's a ceremony that Sherry Mitchell, this is the 10th year of a 21-year vision. So we've got a ways to go on her vision of about a dozen years ago. But Sherry has land out in Monroe. It's called the Land Peace Foundation. And this spring, she and a couple of really skilled carpenters and a bunch of less skilled volunteers built an arbor. It's an outdoor, I don't know, eight-sided with the four directions prominently articulated. And we all sat there for 2 days. And Sherry had invited to this ceremony indigenous people from lots and lots of places. And it was amazing. The elders that she had invited to come talk about their tradition, their ancestors, and their spirit living in this world today, And the goal was with those elders, with their ancestors, and with all of us sitting in the seats, many indigenous people, but more non-indigenous people, creating a single prayer that would rise up on the smoke of the fire in the center of the arbor and just go up. But these folks came, at least. There were Penobscots, Passamaquoddies, Mi'kmaqs, Wolastoqs, Onondaga, Mohawk, Anishinaabe, Havasupai, Hopi, Toltec, Filipinos, Maori. There was a man from Mongolia, one from Kyrgyzstan, woman from Siberia, woman from India, and a few more. And they came as indigenous representatives of their tradition, carrying their ancestors into this place in small town Maine to build one prayer together. Now, she invited a couple of religious folks along too. A couple of Unitarian Universalist ministers showed up, invited. Some of us showed up just in the peanut gallery, but Sarah Heyman was there. She had a rabbi, she had Buddhist monks, she had somebody from the Baha'i tradition, she had two people from the Christian tradition, and Sherry is saying to us, we each carry our tradition. We each have a relationship with our own ancestors. And the task right now is to come together and build a single prayer for ourselves, for each other, and for Mother Earth. Listening to those elders from various traditions, it's clear that their stories are so meaningful. And we can benefit from their lives, their teaching, their guidance. The ancestors about whom they speak have gone on into the realm of ancestors, and yet they live. Because they live through their descendants, they live through the story, through the ceremony, through the ritual. The healing that they manifested in their lives is being carried. The hope for this world that they had in the midst of sometimes unspeakable crap is carried. The love that they shared is carried. It's carried. We think we're living in challenging times, and I won't deny it. But it's important to understand that our ancestors survived unspeakable conditions, very trying times, and they survived. And because they survived, we are here. Sherry Mitchell reminded us that those of us who are not Penobscot or Indigenous also have ancestors, and we also have tradition. And part of our responsibility right now is, if we don't already, to become familiar with our own tradition and our own ancestors. Because they're there. They're there. I came away from this sort of deep sharing with mostly Penobscot people and other indigenous folks with what I can only sort of describe as tradition envy. The Penobscots have been on this land, and DNA tests have demonstrated the veracity of this statement, for 11,000 years. An unbroken line. I don't have any such thing. I don't even know where my great-greats lived. And so that sense of that long line of tradition, I think some of us who are descendants of European Americans, colonizers, if you will, migrants, if you will, expatriates, if you will, people who survived the Middle Passage, if you will. Sometimes I think we're hungry for that sense of who am I and where do I belong? When people talk about their spiritual tradition, that they're saying the prayers and practicing the rituals that their people have held for 11,000 years, and I think, oh, geez, my religious rituals and practices go back to 1960. But they do. And they go back farther because there's Unitarians and Universalists. My physical ancestors, I have one British, English great-grand, and three German. Christy and I are going with three of my sisters and another spouse to England next month. And we're going to chase down my mother's 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 place. She was of a family that was in Stoke-on-Trent in the potteries business, making fine English bone china. She married a fella from County Durham, which is coal mining territory. And George tells in one of his stories, of family stories, that he grew up working in the coal mine, like his dad, and he had saved enough money so that at age 11, he left the coal mining and went to school. And the school he went to was the divinity school, because that's the school young men could go to, and he became a minister, Methodist, blah, 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 eventually came to the United States as a missionary. My grandmother was born in Broken Bow, Nebraska. So we know a little bit about tradition, and I know that some of my ancestors come out of one or another version of the Christian histories. But thinking about ancestors and tradition, I have the sense that I, and maybe everyone, and maybe you, will be better prepared and equipped to live through our time, the coming years, if I have my tradition and my ancestors as companions and resources, as my strength and my comfort. And I turned at that point to Stephen Charleston. Stephen Charleston is a Choctaw Native elder, and he is a bishop of the Episcopal Church. He has learned in his 80 years to straddle two somewhat different traditions, and he represents both of them very well. What Stephen Charleston does is he says, I have my tradition, but my ancestors and your ancestors are no different. There is a point at which the ancestors become the ancestors, and their spirit and their energy and their wisdom is available to anyone who can calm their mind and open their heart enough to sit and wait for the wisdom. And it's not as if we get automatic writing, or some of us, but not all of us, voices that come and say specific things. It's really as much a sense of sitting and asking for the wisdom of the ages. Those ancestors survived. We're not facing anything more difficult than they did, and they had no better tools to face it than what we have. And as Stephen Charleston said, they got by, and they made it, and so will we. And so will we. He says, as a bishop, he feels as though his work in this world is to manifest and share love and let the judging be handled elsewhere by whatever your version of the divine is. And he said, I'm very comfortable with that. I don't want the responsibility. I just want to be able to share love. And that's what he gets from his ancestors. How do we do this? In what settings do we do this? And he has a lot of, he does a daily meditation. It's three or four sentences And I get it, not every day, but lots of days. He says, there's no way out of this current time in which we are living except to live through it. Help would be nice. So for me, I have my tradition of maybe English ancestors, maybe German ancestors, but I also have my Unitarian Universalist ancestors. And I have to also a degree my Christian ancestors, a lot of ministers in my heritage. But for those of us who don't necessarily know or don't necessarily carry that unbroken tradition, we have to find our way. And if we've found our way to Unitarian Universalism, we've got some great examples of ancestors who have survived and thrived in difficult times. I might mention John Murray, who was the first Universalist to preach on the shores of New Jersey. We had Theodore Parker, Unitarian minister, who was barred from other Unitarian pulpits because his message of abolition was without qualification. And you may or may not know that there were Unitarians in New England who were not abolitionists. And the story goes that Theodore Parker kept a revolver in his desk drawer in his study because he had runaways in his basement. So we have people like that. We have people like Olympia Brown, the first female ordained into the Universalist Church. She went through really unspeakable disrespect, but she turned out to be a fabulous speaker. The Olympia Brown Church is in Racine, Wisconsin. James Luther Adams, who talked about the seven smooth stones of Unitarianism, every minister has preached that sermon. Y'all don't remember it, but I preached it in 2017. Sophia Foss, sort of the mother of religious education that respects the minds and the imagination of children. These are our ancestors, the people we carry with us. Stephen Charlson says this, your ancestors gather around you, generations of lives like yours, dedicated to the sacred path, compassionate toward the stranger, sources of love like pools of water in the desert. Your ancestors surround you, a wall of protection. They uphold you. They lift you above the chaos to give you time to think. Look with the vision of your heart. You are not alone. You will never be alone, for your ancestors gather around you. The ancestors carry us. They were troubled as we are. Those who came before us were troubled for the same reasons, fear of illness, a broken heart, fights in the family, threats of war, corrupt politicians. They walked through these disasters, not without being harmed, but surviving. Our culture is not meant to honor ancestors as a quaint spirituality of the past, but as a living source of strength for the present. For they lived through their time, and we will live through our time. Our ancestors are watching us. They have seen enough in their own lives to know what we're going through. We can sit and ask for the wisdom that we need for any day. Open our spirits to those eternal grandparents who are still a part of your spiritual world. For John O'Donohue, whose tradition is both native indigenous Celtic spirituality and Roman Catholicism, May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. Blessed be, you know I love you. Amen.